Okay, last week's lecture was pretty dense, I think. I hope it was accessible, but the ideas were actually pretty complicated. These are issues that bedevil even sophisticated sociologists. My graduate students grapple with this question: what do we really mean by class? What are these different ways of thinking about it? I just want to briefly go back over the main punchlines from last lecture to bring home the central ideas. So first, just to recapitulate, these three broad approaches to class. The first one identifies this concept simply with the attributes of persons. Individual attributes. One person's class position does not in any sense affect anyone else's. Now, this idea corresponds to some pretty broad intuitions in American society. We have what is often thought of as a pretty individualistic culture. People are supposed to be responsible for their own fate. You know, we're a world of grasshoppers and ants, to use the Aesop's story. Some people do better in life than others. They differ in their attributes from others. Well, that seems like a reasonable way of classifying people. And one of the attributes that you have is your education. Another is your kind of cultural sophistication. A third is your income, your standard of living, your wealth, and so on. And if these all hang together, you know, if it's the case that these personal attributes that you carry with you, like your education, your sense of responsibility, your resilience, all these dispositions that are part of you, if they hang together with these material conditions of life, well, then we can say that this is a class structure, not just a structure of inequality, not just a pattern of inequality. That's the individual attributes approach. That corresponds to a lot of what people, I think, in their spontaneous or unreflected thinking, what a lot of people think. Both the opportunity hoarding and the domination and exploitation approaches to classes, both of these other approaches take a very different point of departure. Now, it's not that these approaches deny that individuals differ in their personal attributes. No, of course, some people are very hardworking, other people are not. And whether or not you're hardworking may help to explain why you, as a particular person, end up where you are. So individual attributes remain of sociological relevance, but they don't explain the nature of the positions into which people end up. The positions themselves have a social meaning and reality that's independent of the processes that sort people into them. That's why I gave that, you know, contrived example of the grading system, right? Where, you know, a professor decides ahead of time that only one person is going to get an A. And indeed, the person who worked the hardest got the A. And so you can really say, yes, I've explained why Mary got the A, because she just worked harder than everybody else and maybe was smarter as well or whatever. But clearly, that doesn't explain why there was only one A to be got. It explains why Mary got the one A that there was, but not why the structure had that character. That was determined by this powerful figure who was defined by his relationship to the students. A powerful figure who just decides arbitrarily, I'm going to be mean and nasty and give only one A in the class. Well, the opportunity hoarding and domination exploitation approaches both try to figure out how should we understand the nature of the positions themselves. What the opportunity hoarding perspective says as a key feature of positions is how they exclude people from access, how they create barriers to getting into it, how they create, in one sense, a kind of property right in the position itself. Now, that's clearest in the case of actual property rights, right? An employer owns the means of production, owns a firm, and has the right to exclude anybody from access to the jobs in the firm. That is a relationship, then. It's the fact that you're in a position to exclude others defines a relationship between you and others. It's a relational idea of your position. The opportunity hoarding perspective simply says the advantages of being in a privileged class position causally depends upon these processes of exclusion. So there's a connection between being advantaged and disadvantaged, and the connection comes through these processes of exclusion. Credentials are another form of exclusion. Citizenship, that's a really powerful and potent form of exclusion. You know, the whole controversy about immigration, about illegal immigrants. Well, their illegality is a statement of an exclusionary mechanism which prevents them from competing for jobs in the United States. They're excluded, and that mechanism of exclusion is indeed an opportunity hoarding mechanism. Okay, so that's the second general approach to class. Classes are defined in this approach by the processes by which people get excluded from access to certain positions, which then is an attribute of the structure, not of the persons themselves. And then finally, we get to this most complex in many ways, and certainly the most controversial approach, which is identified as the domination and exploitation approach to understanding the nature of the structure itself, the relations that bind people's lives together. And it says the advantages of being in a privileged class position causally depend on two things, not just one. Exclusion, so it shares that with the opportunity hoarding approach, but there's another element, which is controlling the activities of others. The key thing being identified here is that, again, in the simplest of cases, the relationship between an employer and an employee is not simply that the employer has the right and the power to exclude employees from the firm. They can do that. They can fire a worker. They also have the right to control what the employee does. That's an additional issue. It's an additional issue. Controlling the labor of someone else. And the well-being and advantages of the privileged position, again, privileged position, not just the privileged person in the position, but of the position itself, the advantages come from the control it confers over the lives of others, not simply from the power it confers to exclude others. That's a pretty interesting kind of social relationship. If you pursue sociology or history or other social sciences, you will continually encounter this kind of social relation where you have advantaged and disadvantaged people whose lives are bound up with each other, who depend upon each other. And this creates very difficult forms of conflict. There's always this problem if you're an employer. I mean, I'm sure some of you come from families in which a parent was a business person and had employees. Maybe some of you have been in managerial positions at some point and have had to control the labor of others. There's always the problem of getting people to do what you want them to do, and especially getting them to work as hard as you'd like them to work. You know, we can make a distinction between what can be called the whistle while you work level of effort. That's an allusion to Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the Walt Disney version, where the Seven Dwarfs are these miners who just love mining. It's their passion. And when they go off to work, there's this little tune. You know, whistle while you work. Well, that's the level of work effort you expend if nobody's coercing you. It's just the level of work effort that comes from your spontaneous love of mining, in the case of the Seven Dwarfs. Mostly, the nature of the social relation that binds together the lives of employers and employees, in most instances, creates a situation where the level of work effort desired by the employer is higher than the whistle while you work level of effort of the employee. And that creates a problem. How do you extract labor effort? That's the exploitation problem. And that's a way more complicated type of social relationship that defines the nature of the structure of positions than simply excluding someone. And it's certainly way more complicated than seeing inequality as simply the cumulative effect of the attributes of persons. All right, that's the recapitulation of that complex conceptual space. And I won't go through this again. That yields this composite picture of the American class structure as having five kinds of positions, the sorts of social locations that get generated by these multiple processes. This is on page 265 and 6 of the book, so you can review the explanation of these class positions by looking at the book. And now on to today's topic. Today's topic is persistent poverty and increasing inequality. What I want to do is two sorts of things. I'm going to begin by just very briefly reviewing some of the facts of the matter that are laid out in the book. I had hoped to update all the data for this part of the course in particular from the data in the book, which are mostly in the 2010, 2012, maybe some data goes as far as 2013. But my encounter with a car while biking in November kind of knocked me off of my plans. And so this is still data from a few years ago. But mostly things haven't changed in any dramatic way. There'd be very small differences. So you can pretty reliably, I think, treat the figures that I'm giving you today as characterizing the state of affairs in the United States. Poverty has declined a little bit in the last couple of years because there's been some economic improvement from the big crisis, but not dramatically. So I'm going to review these data, present you, you know, graphs and charts, which you should get you should really look at these and be sure that you understand the point of these graphs. It's the point of the numbers that really matter. And if you really have that in your bones, then you'll be able to answer questions when these are invoked in the next midterm exam. And then I'm going to turn to the question of, well, how do we explain this? Why is there such persistent poverty in the United States? What's the underlying explanation, sociological explanations for why we have such persistent poverty and such increasing inequality? There's two things to explain: the level of poverty and the amount of inequality. But first, a little tour through data. These are pie charts showing the distribution of household income and household net financial assets. Net assets means you have a certain amount of wealth and you have a certain amount of debt, and you subtract your debt from your wealth and you get your net assets. You know, so if you have a home and it would sell on the market for $500,000 and you have a $300,000 mortgage outstanding on it, you have $200,000 of net wealth. The value of your house, if you were to sell it, minus your debts, which are the unpaid part of your mortgage. Okay, so, and these are households rather than just individuals. Households are usually the way we think about a person's standard of living, since members of a household more or less pool their income or their wealth. But sometimes individual earnings are a more important thing to study than just household. Just so you're really clear on the distinction, income is a flow. You refer to a person's income per year, for example. Most of this data that I'll be presenting is annual income. Wealth is a stock. It's the value of what you own at a particular point in time. For most people, the main asset they own, if they own any assets, is their home. Cars would also be considered an asset. An asset is really anything you own which you could sell and get cash for, you could get money for. You know, so the clothing that you're wearing, if it's reasonably worn out, isn't an asset. It's clothing, you can wear it, but you really couldn't sell it for much. It's not worth much. There's not much of a market for tattered clothing in the United States. Okay, household income. What these graphs divide is the total pie into three groups. The richest 1% of the population, of the households. The next richest 9%, so those, the yellow and red together, are the top 10%. And the bottom 90% of households. So first for income, the richest 1% of households earn in 2010, 28% of the annual income in the whole country. 1% of the population earns 28% of total income. Oh, that was my cane flopping over. 90% of the population earn just a little over half of the total income in the country. That's pretty unequal, but it's nowhere near as unequal as wealth. So these are the assets you own. It's your total wealth minus your debts. The bottom 90% of the population own only 15% of the wealth in the country. The top 1% earns 42% of all wealth in the country. That's a pretty unequal distribution of the pie. And as we saw a couple of lectures ago when we looked at that little video which compared what people thought would be the ideal and what people thought was the actual, this is far from what most Americans feel would be desirable if they could just take up a pie and divide it up. What they would think would be the ideal distribution of wealth or income in the society, almost nobody would say, yeah, the best of all possible societies is one in which 90% of the population only own 15% of the wealth. Or that 1% owns 42% of the wealth. The thing about this distribution, particularly of wealth, when you really think about it, it's not just that it makes for an inequality of wealth as such. This also reflects a huge inequality in opportunity. If you're that wealthy, you have all sorts of opportunities that you would not have if you weren't. The ability of college-age kids to do unpaid internships, which is a crucial part of the current career structure for many lines of work that people want to pursue, depends in part upon the wealth of parents. Also, when you have this degree of inequality of wealth, one would suspect that it gets translated into inequality of political power as well. Your ability to influence government to do things in your favor, it seems just implausible that this isn't closely connected to this degree of inequality of wealth. Which means that inequality of wealth is not just contained within the space of economic inequality, it's translated into political inequality, and thus is a serious erosion of democratic quality of life. Okay, we'll be discussing that issue in the next section. This graph shows the pattern over time. This is referred to these days as the great U-turn in inequality. The richest 10% of Americans, this is households, I think. I'm pretty sure this is households. The richest 10% of households in the 1910s up to through the 1920s earned somewhere between 40 and 50% of the total earnings in the country. This declined a bit to the mid-40s from the high just before the Great Depression during the 30s. And then during the World War II and for the subsequent three decades, inequality dropped quite dramatically. The richest 10% of the population had their share of total income decline to only a little, in the lower 30s. Since the early 1980s, this has risen steadily. Something happened in the 1970s. So that around, roughly speaking, 1980, inequality begins to rise. there's some ups and downs, you know, which correspond to economic recessions and the like. But basically, it's been a steady increase until now. It is essentially at the level that it was in the Gilded Age before World War II. Well, before the Great Depression. This is the income inequalities of the income between the top 1% and the top 10%. So this is the 9% of the population that's just below the very top. And this is the richest 1% of the population. The richest 1% of the population had their proportion of total income increase from 9% in the 1970s, which means that they got, so to speak, disproportionately nine times as much as a purely equal distribution, to 22.5% in 2012. The top 1% gets over 20% of total national income. This graph is a reprise of a graph we looked at before, which reflects what's really changed, that we're really in a very different world during your lifetimes, for most of you. One exception I see in the back of the room. Your lifetimes, you know, most of you were born after 1979, I assume. In your lifetime, we are living in the world on the right, where the annual rate of growth of income by income group is monotonically increasing as you move from the poorest to the richest. Whereas in the 30 years following World War II, it was just a very different problem, pattern. You know, there's this expression, a rising tide lifts all boats. That's basically the idea that as productivity increases and the wealth of an economy increases, that improves the life of everybody. All boats rise more or less at the same. Well, from 1947 to 79, if anything, the rising tide lifted the worst off boats more than it did the best off boats. This was a period of relatively egalitarian distribution of the gains. It was still an unequal society. It's not that we had an equal distribution, but the gains of economic growth were pretty equally distributed in the population, and if anything, tilted a bit towards people more at the bottom of the income distribution than people at the very top. That has changed. I know I'm just kind of bashing this point, but here's another way of representing it. These are ratios comparing different groups to the middle, the median income. So you take the median at, you know, the very center of the economy, the household that's dead smack in the middle of the distribution. The red line is the ratio of the top 1% to the middle, how that has changed. The blue line is the ratio of the group just below the top, that is people in the 96th to 99th percentile, the next 4% to the middle. And the bottom line is the ratio of the middle to the bottom 20%. Not the very bottom of the bottom. You know, the bottom 20% is pretty poor. That's kind of at the poverty line, or slightly below the poverty line, 20%. It's right around the poverty line. The bottom 10% is really desperately poor. So this is comparing the middle to the bottom 20%. Now that really hasn't changed much. You know, the ratio of the average income of somebody at the very middle, the median household, and the bottom 20%, that ratio has been pretty stable. The middle person in the middle earns about 2.5 to 3 times what a person at that bottom 20% earns. The ratio at the very top has just increased. The top to the middle has just increased dramatically. In 1979, a person at the top, a household at the top, earned about 10 times what the household in the middle of the income distribution earns. Now it's over 20 times. And it reached as high as approaching 30 times before the Great Recession. And it, by the way, that if this had continued, this particular graph had continued to the present, the red line would be back up above 25 now. This issue of what's going on at the top, what's really interesting is if you go to the top of the top and the very top of the top of the top, you know, this is what mathematicians would say is a fractal problem. At every scale, the rate of growth is higher as you move further up the distribution. This is earnings growth at the very top between 1972 and 2001. So this is out of date. I couldn't get these statistics updated. But in that period, that's a 30-year period, the top 10% had their income increase by 20 or 30%, the top 1% almost 100%, the top 10th of a percent approaching 200%, and the top 100th of a percent of the distribution had their income increase 500% in that period. Another way of representing these data is by looking at structures of positions. So this is more like the class structure analysis that I presented. If we look at the ratio of the average CEO pay to the average worker from 1965 to 2007, you see that in the 60s and into the 70s, CEOs of big American corporations, you know, General Motors, IBM, there wasn't a Google back then, but you know, the various large corporations, CEOs of corporations earned somewhere between 20 and 40 times what an average worker earned. These are average workers in the firms of those CEOs. So this statistics is calculated by looking within corporations at the ratio between the top and the average worker. That increased to 300 times by 2000 and has remained between 250 and over 300 since then. A CEO earns typically in a day what it takes the average employee in the same firm a whole year to earn. 306, you know, over 300 times more. This again is another representation of the same phenomenon. In this case, it's looking at the difference between the richest executives and the average executive. I won't go through this complicated chart more, and I won't ask you about this complicated chart on the exam, but you might want to look at it. It's kind of interesting, more detail. Finally, there is the question, well, what about these super rich people? Are they all, you know, maybe they're all just self-made people who earned their fabulously high earnings because of their being clever and working hard, rather than this reflecting advantages that they entered with. Well, that just turns out not to be the case. This is data from the early 2000s. I, again, don't believe there's any indication that that this pattern has changed. So we're looking at the class origins of people who are in the Forbes 400 list of the wealthiest people in the United States. So this is less than that 0.01%. It's the very, very top of the top. The 400 wealthiest people in the United States. Over 40% of them came from families that were already in the top 400. So 40% of the top wealthiest 400 people come from families in the top 400 families. Another 5% had inherited substantial wealth, over $50 million. Another 6 or 7% had inherited at least $1 million. Only about 30% could be described as genuinely coming from non-wealthy backgrounds. So it's not the case that the people at the very top of this structure are primarily people who have made fortunes simply on the basis of their own initiatives. Well, that's the portraits of general inequality. Now let's look at an empirical portrait of poverty in America. Again, I will go fairly rapidly through this. These figures are all in the book and discussed in more detail. So first, comparing the United States to other countries. We are basically the developed country with the highest level of poverty rates in the developed world. 17.3%. This, I don't have the date on this figure. I suppose it's somewhere around 2010. I don't have it on the graph. The dates will be in the book. Of the American population live in poverty. And this compares to under 10% in most European countries. This graph shows changes in child poverty in the United States, both for children under 6 and children under 18, along with changes in the national income, gross domestic product per capita. This is defining poverty by the American poverty line. Just as a technical note, there are two ways in discussions of poverty that people define poverty. There's what's called relative poverty and absolute poverty. Absolute poverty defines a basket of goods, and if you can afford to buy that basket, then you're above the poverty line. Relative poverty is usually defined as earning less than half of the median earnings of the society. Now, the reason for a relative poverty measure is that it makes it easier to compare countries. It's difficult to compare countries with an absolute poverty line measure for all sorts of reasons. For example, if you are in a country that has universal free health care available to everybody and universal free education through university available to everyone, well, that means something different, what your actual earnings are. So should the poverty line include the fact that in some places you have access to free goods and in other places not? It becomes just difficult to draw comparable figures when you use an absolute poverty line. There's also, of course, difficulties because the costs of living are very different in different places. And that makes an absolute poverty line a tricky thing to measure cross-nationally. So typically when people do cross-national research comparing countries, they use this idea of relative poverty, living at less than half of the middle of the income distribution. That means you're poor relative to the distribution in the society in which you live. Now, you can have an income distribution in which no one lives less than half. You know, you can have income support programs, which basically means that once you take into account income support, you know, that is the actual income you have available, nobody is less than half of the median earnings. So it's, the relative poverty measure doesn't imply that it is, there will always be a significant number of people who earn half of the, whatever the middle of the income distribution is. Well, what this graph in any case shows is the relationship between growing income in the country as a whole and the persistence of poverty. And this, just the striking thing to note is, this is a poverty line. This is people who live below the official government-determined poverty line, which I believe the poverty line today for a family of four is in the low 20,000s. If you earn, I don't know exactly what the figure is for 2017, but if you're a family of four and you earn $22,000 a year, that would put you below the poverty line. If you earned $30,000 a year, you'd be above the poverty line. And I don't know what the cutoff point is. Now, normally one would expect that as national income goes up, the proportion of the population living below the poverty line should go down when it's an absolute measure. That would be true if increasing wealth of the country was distributed at all evenly. But as we see, this is not the case. And it's particularly troubling because it's not the case for young children. Now note that between the 1959 and the end of the 1960s, it was the case that poverty rates declined quite sharply in line with the increasing wealth of the country in that period. But since the 1970s, it has not been the case. There's been some rises and some falls, but there has been no continuing erosion of poverty as the country has become wealthier. This is the this chart shows the growth of intense poverty. Intense poverty is poverty that in which people earn less than half of the poverty line. That would be a family of four living on around $10,000 or $11,000 a year. And that has steadily increased over the last 40 years or so. This graph shows the poverty rates within racial and ethnic groups and how that has changed over time. For whites, it's remained roughly constant over the last 40 years or so, 45 years at around 10%, sometimes below, sometimes at 10%. For blacks and Hispanics, it's varied, mostly hovering around the 25% rate, up and down. It's important to know that there are more poor whites than poor blacks and poor Hispanics, not than poor blacks and Hispanics taken together. But it's not the case that most poor people are black. It's the case that in the black population, in the African American population, there's a higher rate of population. But 42% of all poor people in the United States were white, not Hispanic. 28% were Hispanic, and 21% were black. So there is a racial disproportion in poverty, but poverty is a broad problem in the country, in which a substantial proportion, over 40% of poor people, are poor white people. Well, that's my rapid tour through just data. Now let's approach the problem of, well, how do we explain this? How should we approach the explanation of persistent poverty and inequality? But I'm going to focus more on poverty because the poverty side of inequality is the side that I think has the most moral salience. The inequality side does have moral relevance, but it has its relevance partially because it's connected to poverty, but also because it's connected to power. But I'm going to focus more on the poverty issue. There are two broad types of explanations. You know, if you survey the sociological literature, and indeed if you survey the economics literature as well, as a first cut, you can say there are two big types of explanations. Sometimes they get combined. These can be called, if you want a slogan, you know, to keep these clear in your head, there's the blame the victim and blame society. Blame the victim. The basic idea, I think, is pretty straightforward. The problem is in the attributes of poor people. The solution, therefore, is to change the person, not the society. This has a pretty simple reasoning, right? So this is a nice little syllogism. Some people who are born poor become rich, or become non-poor, if you want to make it a little bit more open, but for simplicity, let's just say you're either rich or poor. Those are the only two possibilities. Some people are born poor, become rich, others do not. Sometimes even within a family. So there are endless cases where you have a family in really quite dire poverty. There's siblings, there's a number of children, and one of the kids makes it and prospers, and the others don't. There must be something different between those who stay poor and those who do not, which explains the different outcomes. So if you have two brothers in a household, and Bob ends up graduating from, they're both poor. Their parents were uneducated. They live in a terrible part of town. Bob studies hard and graduates from college and becomes a successful lawyer. And Jim drops out of high school and lives a life of poverty. And if you want to explain why Bob was successful and Jim not, it seems obvious there must be something different between Bob and Jim. They were in the same family, they had the same parents, they had the same food. There must be something different between these two persons. Therefore, the explanation of poverty must be this individual difference. There must be a personal deficit of some sort that explains why one brother and not another succeeds when they both come from the same situation. That's the basic kind of reasoning that goes into the blame the victim explanation. This is exactly the grasshopper and the ant story, right? In the grasshopper and the ant story, the two critters face the same opportunities. One squanders the opportunities, the other works hard and takes advantage of them. In the story of the two brothers growing up in a desperately poor family, they both face the same lack of opportunity. Nobody would say they had great opportunities, of course, but nevertheless, one of these brothers buckled down, worked hard, and made it out of poverty. And the explanation for why one succeeds and the other doesn't is essentially a grasshopper and the ant type of explanation. The explanation for poverty then is collapsed into an explanation for why particular people are poor. It's a bit like explaining the grade distribution in that concocted story I gave by explaining the differences between the students in the class. It's a fundamental just mistake of logic, in a way, to imagine that because you can explain the differences between two people, you've therefore explained the distribution of outcomes. Now, when blame the victim stories are played out as real social science, you know, and there are sociologists and social scientists who essentially adopt at their heart, you know, there's usually little bits of hedging here and there, but it's essentially a blame the victim kind of explanation. There's two sorts of things that historically have played a role. One is a notion of genetic determinism. That is, the poor are poor because they lack some endowment in their basic genetic capacities. This has been particularly pernicious in racist accounts of poverty. Charles Murray wrote this book, The Bell Curve, very popular in conservative circles in the 1990s, I believe. Maybe it was the late 80s. I think it was in the 1990s, in which he argues that basically persistent poverty among African Americans is due to genetic deficits. And he had a whole theory for where these came from. That's been just utterly debunked by serious social scientists. It's not even a contender for a plausible explanation of the kinds of variations we observe in the world today. A more sophisticated idea, which has more traction, I think, and has some kernels of truth for part of the explanation, is what's called the culture of poverty explanation, which says, no, poor people don't differ biologically from non-poor people. No, that's not the issue. They differ culturally. And in particular, their culture is such that they have difficulty delaying gratification. The culture encourages people to live in the moment. To quote Edward Banfield, who is the anthropologist who coined the expression, the culture of poverty, poverty is explained by the existence of an outlook and style of life which is radically present-oriented and which therefore attaches no value to work, sacrifice, self-improvement, or service to family, friends, and community. And that's seen as a cultural attribute which children learn from their parents and their community. Sometimes these cultural attributes are themselves seen as the result of historic oppression and discrimination, so there may be a social explanation of the cultural deficits. But the persistence of poverty is seen as a cycle, a vicious cycle, that's embedded in the attributes of persons. And once embedded, the argument goes, it's extremely hard to change. Cultural inferiority has replaced genetic inferiority as the primary way that these sorts of blame the victim explanations play out. And there are elements of it which have some value. There can be adaptations to harsh conditions which create traps for people. But it remains an explanation that's anchored in the descriptions of persons and their dispositions rather than in the structure which they live in. Now, it's important to note, and I think this is a really important thing to think about. It doesn't settle the question of whether the blame the victim theory is a good or bad theory, but it should at least make us suspicious of it. And that is the ideological attractiveness of blame the victim to people who have advantages. After all, it's a pretty painless way of explaining social problems if you are on the top to say that it's the fault of the people at the bottom, that it's their fault. The poor should take responsibility for their own plight and stop complaining. You know, that kind of ideological comfort that comes from blame the victim should at least make one suspicious when a wealthy person or well-funded think tank sees that the central problem of poverty is cultural deficits among the poor. Now again, the fact that we can impugn the motives of people saying these things does not prove the theory is wrong. I mean, I think we should absolutely insist on a kind of scientific standard. You have to provide evidence for and against an argument, but it should make one suspicious. Just like when rich people argue that we need tax cuts for the rich in order to help the poor, you might think maybe that's self-serving and it's just justifying what's in their own interests by making a claim that it's in the interests of everyone, even though it isn't. Again, it could be true. I believe it's not, but it could be true that continual tax cuts for the rich benefit everybody. The evidence of the last 40 years, when we saw that in the first 40 years after the 30 years after the Second World War, a rising tide lifted all boats, and in the era of tax cuts at the top, a rising tide lifts the earnings at the top. That should be at least suggestive that maybe there's a flaw in the argument about tax cuts for the rich benefiting everyone. And one suspects when you hear people making justifications for things that benefit themselves by claiming it benefits everyone, or explanations of the poor that it's their fault, one should at least be suspicious. That should make you ask for a high standard of evidence to support such claims. Well, that's blame the victim. Let's look at blame society. The basic idea of blame society is that circumstances vary much more between the poor and the non-poor than do personalities, motivations, values, or culture. Circumstances vary much more dramatically between people than do their motivations, personalities, or values. I mean, let's just compare. Middle class, this is a kind of stereotype of middle class people versus poor people. On the claims that they really do differ in their motivations, look at the delayed gratification problem. That's at the core of the culture of poverty. The culture of poverty thesis has as its very core that poor people can't delay gratification. They can't save. They don't have an orientation towards the future. The credit card debt problem is a massive problem for middle-income people. The accumulation of debt is a very big problem for the middle class. What is credit card debt if it isn't a difficulty in delaying gratification? When experiments are done in a lab experiments to test the extent to which children from middle class and poor families have an ability to delay gratification to get a higher reward later, there's no class differences. There's big differences among people. There are kids, you know, who just can't delay gratification at all. They're have the opportunity of one marshmallow now or two marshmallows later. They just find it really tough to resist the one marshmallow now. And there are other kids who are really good at delaying gratification. But it's not a there's no class difference in it. Or let's take another example. Crime. Is it the case that poor people commit more crime than more affluent people? There's absolutely no evidence that they do. What the evidence is overwhelming that they commit different kinds of crime. Most theft in the United States is by well-heeled people. People with income commit the vast amount of theft in the United States. They just do it in a way that goes unobserved. Tax cheating is a form of theft. Tax cheating is a massive theft from the collective pot of resources for solving social problems. Tax cheating is way more common among middle and upper income people than it is among the poor. If you ask yourself the question, well, why does a poor person rob from a grocery store, a convenience store, and a rich person embezzle from a bank? The simplest explanation is that a rich person has the opportunity to embezzle from the bank, to inflate an expense account. To inflate expense accounts. I mean, how many businessmen do you imagine, when they go on trips, are scrupulous in the report of their expenses? Well, there'll be some. There's no doubt that there are plenty of people in every class who are scrupulously honest, who don't cheat, who don't steal from, as it were, the relevantly vulnerable sources that they could steal from and get away with. Well, lots of executives can steal from their companies because they know they can get away with it. They just inflate their expense account when they go on a trip. And I know professors who double dip. You know, they have a grant which pays for a trip to give a lecture, and they get their travel expenses paid by the university that invited them. And they do it twice. Now, I do think that's pretty rare. You know, I mean, I haven't looked at my colleagues' books to see if they're cheating or not. I think it's pretty rare. I think the kind of standard of honesty in the academy is pretty high, but it certainly isn't perfect. And it's obvious why poor people don't inflate their expense accounts. But which is a more lucrative way of getting extra money illegally? Obviously, it's easier to inflate an expense account than it is to, you know, steal from a store. Well, I'm belaboring a point, but it's just, to me, it's just trivially obvious that the opportunities vary gigantically between people, much more than do their personal attributes. So there are some differences in attributes, of course, and they may help to explain, so to speak, why Mary got the A. But these are way less fundamental than the differences in the circumstances. And that's why in Sweden there's way less poverty than the United States. It's not that the distribution of attributes of Swedes, as far as I know, Swedes might be lazier than the average American. I don't know. It's possible. European academics, when they come to the United States, are kind of astonished at how hard American academics work. We are definitely seen as kind of off the deep end, since we eat at our desks at lunch and keep working throughout the day rather than going out for a nice leisurely lunch with a glass of wine. Americans tend to be workaholics, right? So there are differences, but the reason why there are relatively few poor people in Sweden and not the United States is because of the structure. It's not because there's some difference in the distribution of attributes of persons. And this is the basic take-home message of this contrast. Even when individual attributes are relevant to explaining poverty, even when they play a role, they are never a sufficient explanation. The lower education and schooling levels of poor people in the United States, in part caused because of lousy schools in the cities, in central cities and in some rural areas, is surely part of the explanation for poverty, but it is not the crucial explanation. Because less educated people under other structures will not be poor. It's always at least an explanation that requires an account of the nature of the positions that are provided by the society and the distribution of attributes that enable people to fill those positions. Well, if we're going to therefore say, maybe there's a little bit of truth in the blame the victim, individual attributes matter, but the heart of the matter is the structural explanations of inequality and poverty. The next step, of course, is to say, well, we need to go beyond just this vague idea of structural explanation. We need to actually provide an explanation. What is the structural explanation for poverty? How should we think about it? I think there are three aspects of this problem. If we really want to sort out the ways in which inequality is generated and poverty is reproduced over time as properties of the social structure, we have to tackle three problems. The first is marginalization, the processes which exclude people from labor markets altogether. The second is the processes which generate inequality within labor markets. And the third are processes which generate inequality in wealth. These are interconnected, but really quite distinct topics, problems to be solved. Marginalization, that's exclusion from labor markets. What kicks people out, prevents them entering labor markets? What happens within labor markets that generates earnings inequality? And what happens in the distribution of wealth? What are the processes that generate inequalities in the assets people own, not just the earnings they receive? So let's look at each of these in turn. First, social structural causes of inequality and poverty, marginalization. Here is the definition. Marginalization is the process of being excluded from stable participation in the labor force. This is an opportunity hoarding problem, right? That's the central idea of opportunity hoarding. Is there some opportunities which, if you could get them, would be good for you, but you're excluded through some process or other? There are three issues here. First, there's a simple observation. There's a lack of adequate employment for people with low skills or outmoded skills. That's just an observation. We observe in the world today, if you look at people who are out of the labor force, who can't find work, they are much more likely to be low-skilled or high-skilled but with outmoded skills. And there just aren't enough jobs that require those particular personal attributes. Skill is a personal attribute. It's something you carry with you. And alas, there are just not enough jobs for people like that. That's an observation. But I think it's a mistake to see this as simply a problem of a lack of skills. It's just as much a problem of the lack of job creation for people with those kinds of skills. There are plenty of tasks that need to be done within the United States today that require relatively little skill in the sense of formal training and education. There's lots of things, lots of needs that need to be filled, that could be filled. Tasks to be done that don't, in fact, require a lot of skill. The problem is they can't be done profitably. That is, the labor market and the capitalist form of the creation of jobs just doesn't create those kinds of jobs in adequate numbers to be filled by all the people who would be willing to do that kind of work at a reasonable wage. Here's just an example. Elder care. Or rehabilitating the infrastructure of crumbling cities, or energy retrofitting of buildings. Okay, energy retrofitting of buildings is a manual job. It doesn't require a lot of skill. You can be trained to do an energy retrofitting pretty easily. But the market doesn't produce a lot of energy retrofitting jobs. The free market doesn't produce it. Turns out to be not all that profitable to do because the people who own the buildings, for them, the upfront costs of all the energy retrofitting will take typically 10 or 15 years to pay back in terms of energy savings. So it might be great for the society as a whole, that is in the long run, if we, you know, really energy retrofit all of our buildings, that would make for a green, much greener economy, greener society. But it's not profitable for the owner of the building, and therefore the owner of the firms that do energy retrofitting don't have a big market for energy retrofitting. But it's clearly a need, and it doesn't require a lot of skills. It's just that the market doesn't provide those jobs. So when we observe that there's lots of people whose skills don't match the available jobs, one strategy is to blame the victim, to say those people should get more skills. They have a deficit in skills. The problem lies in their lack of skills. Rather than saying it's just as much a problem of the lack of appropriate jobs for people with those kinds of skills. Now, if we lived in a world where there really wasn't anything that needed to be done with relatively low skills, if we couldn't say, yes, the society would be better off if we actually did energy retrofitting, or if we did have a much more expanded form of elder care, and a whole variety of other things you can think of. If it were the case that really those tasks didn't need to be done, then one might say, yes, we now do have a case of people who just don't have the necessary skills for the kinds of jobs that need to be done. But that's different from saying they don't have the necessary skills for the kinds of jobs provided by the market. Those are two different claims. Now, I'm not saying that it wouldn't be a good thing to improve the skills of people who lack them. Of course it's a good thing. More education is better than less education. Good skill training programs that enable people to retool and become effective for the private labor market, that's also a good thing. My point, however, is that with respect to this first explanation, this marginalization process, it's incorrect to treat the observation that people are marginalized from the existing labor market because they lack the skills, it's incorrect to say, aha, and that shows the problem is their lack of skills. It's just as much a problem of the lack of production of the right kinds of jobs for the people we have as a failure of the production of the right kinds of people for the jobs we have. And that's particularly true when it turns out, if you really think about it, you don't have to think very hard about it. Turns out that there's just a huge number of things that need to be done in the society that actually don't require a lot of skills. It's just that we don't have a good way of creating those jobs. They won't be provided by the market. They can only be provided by an affirmative state, a state that says, yes, this is a public good. This stuff needs to be done. We will underwrite the retrofitting of housing, the production of elder care, and more expansive after-school programs and daycare programs. We will underwrite this through collective means rather than relying on the market. The consequences of marginalization are intensified and therefore generate deeper forms of marginalization and poverty because of the lack of a real safety net in the United States. Here is a simple comparison that shows the pre-transfer poverty rate and the post-transfer poverty rate. So let me explain what that means. The pre-transfer poverty rate is what's the rate of poverty in different countries, just looking at how much income people acquire through the market. You know, kind of the standard idea, you earn income, does that income put you above or below the poverty level? The post-transfer poverty rate takes into account all of the transfers that occur because of public policy. Welfare payments, Medicaid, Social Security, all these kinds of transfer payments. Now, what's striking is that in the United States, all of the transfers you put together make a very small difference in the rate of poverty. Post-transfer poverty is almost as high as pre-transfer poverty. But look at Canada and Sweden. Public policies reduce the actual rate of poverty that people live their lives in by 50%. So that's marginalization. Second story, second structure, you know, sight of causal processes that help us explain inequalities in the United States and the problem of poverty as well. And this has to do with inequalities generated within labor markets, within the employment structure, for those people who get into the employment structure. So the first problem explains why some people don't even get inside the building, so to speak, and the second story is about how do we explain the inequalities within this building, the building of the labor process, the labor market. There are two ways in which you can connect wages to jobs. So here's a kind of interesting way you can think about it. We have two problems to solve. How do we connect people to jobs, and how do we connect wages to jobs? So the marginalization story is how we disconnect some people from jobs. They can't even get good jobs, so they're outside. Second problem is, well, why do some jobs pay a lot and some pay little? How do we connect wages to jobs? Again, to stylize a contrast, there's two kinds of processes by which wages get connected to jobs. Both, by the way, are present. This is not a case where you have to choose one or the other. But the balance between these can vary. The first is individualized competition, intense individualized competition. Everyone is bidding against everyone else, constant jockeying around, employers raising and lowering wages depending upon the supply and demand of labor, a completely unregulated competitive process by which wages get attached to jobs. That's one way of doing it. Another way is to have a labor market that's governed by all sorts of rules which dampen competition. Seniority pay, for example. Seniority pay attached to how long you've been at work dampens individual competition. It means that you can count on getting a pay raise over time just by being a responsible worker, but not by having to outcompete everybody else. Just by being a responsible person. Job security, unions, and other devices for reducing wage spread, a high minimum wage, all of these things are rules that govern how labor markets work. You can have a labor market that has rules that make it extremely hard for unions to form. That's the current situation in Wisconsin. You can have a labor market with rules that make it relatively easy for labor unions to form. That was the rules in Wisconsin 10 years ago. As we saw in one of those earlier slides last week, Wisconsin has relatively less inequality than most other states. My prediction will be that inequality in Wisconsin now is going to rise like it has elsewhere in the country to a greater extent because we have deregulated the labor market. We've made it easier for inequalities to be intensified within labor markets. Well, there are these two kinds of mechanisms. One of the reasons for increasing inequality has been the intensification of competitiveness, which leads to increasing inequality. Americans generally like to think that because competition is a good thing, the more competition, the better, right? So if competition is good, well, then more competition is even better. It's kind of like happiness, right? Happiness is a good thing. More happiness is even better than less happiness. Competition is a good thing. I think a society without any competition would not be a well-ordered and well-functioning society. But it doesn't follow from the importance of having competition that the more intense and cutthroat the competition is, the better. And this is, I think, part of the explanation for what's happened in the last 40 years, why we've had this tremendous escalation in the level of inequality within labor markets. It's because there has been such an intensification of competition within labor markets. One form of this intensification of labor markets is what is called an increase in the importance of winner-take-all competitions. You know, a winner-take-all competition is one in which you have a lot of people competing for some prize, and whoever comes in first gets the whole prize, and everybody else gets nothing. Excuse me. That's the literal winner-take-all competition. The Olympics characterize this. You know, somebody can win a 100-yard dash by a hundredth of a second, and they get the gold medal, and then they get all the endorsements and make millions of dollars. Whereas being a hundredth of a second less, you end up with the silver. It's not that you end up with no glory, but you don't get all the endorsements. Being first is what matters. That's winner take all. Now, winner take all is a very peculiar kind of form of competition, right? It's a very peculiar sort of thing. It means there's no clear relationship between how hard you work or even how talented you are and whether you win, because those very small differences are way out of proportion to any difference in how hard you worked or how talented you are or how much, what your merit is. It's winner take all turns out to be a non, it is meritocratic in the sense that the winner is the best, but it's non-meritocratic in the sense that you don't get anything from having extremely high merit unless you win. Now, to the extent that you have unregulated labor markets, more labor markets tend to have that character. And this undermines the connection between effort and pay or effort and merit. There are lots of other mechanisms that explain why, once you deregulate labor markets, it creates this intensification of competitiveness and this increase in inequality within labor markets. These are discussed in the chapter. I'm running out of time. I can mention a couple more of these, and then I'll wrap this up at the beginning of the next lecture. Deregulation at the bottom end of the labor market, the basic destruction of the minimum wage. The minimum wage in the United States today is lower than it was in the late 1960s. You know, we've had a tremendous increase in productivity over the last 40, 50 years. We've had a tremendous increase in the average income, the median income, the gross national product. But the minimum wage has been flat in real economic terms. If the minimum wage had kept up with productivity, I think the current minimum wage would be around $20 an hour, something like that. This is discussed in the book. Well, when you deregulate the bottom of the labor market, you allow employers to pay really terrible wages. And if people are desperate enough, they'll be prepared to take those jobs. So that's pulling the earning structure down at the bottom. And this has gone along with deregulating in a different way the wage structure at the top, which is what explains this enormous expansion, increase in earnings at the very top of the employment structure. All right, it's a quarter after. I hear the rustling of the masses. We will wrap this up at the beginning of the next time and then talk about solutions.